From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jonathan Franzen drew on his life for his National Book Award-winning novel, The Corrections. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about his new memoir, The Discomfort Zone, which focuses on many of the things that made him uncomfortable as a child and as an adult. Also, we talk with jazz trumpeter, conductor, arranger, and bandleader Gerald Wilson about his long life in music. He started out playing with Jimmy Lunsford's band, arranged for Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, and Bobby Darin, and toured with Billie Holiday, in addition to leading his own band. This year, he won the Jazz Journalists Association's award for Best Large Ensemble. Yesterday, he celebrated his 88th birthday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After drawing on his life for his best-selling novel, The Corrections, my guest Jonathan Franzen has written a memoir called The Discomfort Zone. It was described by Lev Grossman in Time magazine as a wonderful and supremely personal memoir. Franzen's novel, The Corrections, was published in 2001 and won a National Book Award. It revolved around the lives of three adult children who live far away from their aging parents. The opening of Franzen's new memoir is about returning to the house where he grew up in Webster Groves, Missouri. His mother had just died. Franzen was about to turn 40, and his older brothers had given him the job of choosing a realtor to sell the house. Here's a short reading.
For as long as I was in Webster Groves, doing work on behalf of the estate, the liquor shelf would be mine, mine. Ditto the air conditioning, which I set frostily low. Ditto the kitchen freezer, which I found it necessary to open immediately and get to the bottom of, hoping to discover some breakfast sausages, some homemade beef stew, some fatty and savory thing that I could warm up and eat before I went to bed. My mother had been good about labeling food with the date she'd frozen it. Beneath multiple bags of cranberries, I found a package of smallmouth bass that a fisherman neighbor had caught 3 years earlier. Underneath the bass was a 9-year-old beef brisket. I went through the house and stripped the family photos out of every room. My mother had been too attached to the formality of her living room and dining room to clutter them with snapshots. But elsewhere, each windowsill and each tabletop was an eddy in which inexpensively framed photos had accumulated. I filled a shopping bag with the haul from the top of her TV cabinet. I picked another bag's worth from a wall of the family room as from an espaliered fruit tree. Many of the pictures were of grandchildren, but I was represented in them too, here flashing an orthodontic smile on a beach in Florida, here looking hungover at my college graduation, here hunching my shoulders on my ill-starred wedding day, here standing 3 feet away from the rest of my family during an Alaskan vacation that my mother, toward the end, had spent a substantial percentage of her life savings to take us on. The Alaskan picture was so flattering to 9 of us that she'd applied a blue ballpoint pen to the eyes of the 10th, a daughter-in-law, who'd blinked for the photo and who now, with her misshapen ink-dot eyes, looked quietly monstrous or insane. I told myself that I was doing important work by depersonalizing the house before the first realtor came to see it. But if somebody had asked me why it was also necessary that same night to pile the 100-plus pictures on a table in the basement and to rip or slice or pry or slide each photo out of its frame, and then dump all the frames into shopping bags, and stow the shopping bags in cabinets, and shove all the photos into an envelope so that nobody could see them, if somebody had pointed out my resemblance to a conqueror burning the enemy's churches and smashing its icons, I would have had to admit that I was relishing my ownership of the house.
That's Jonathan Franzen reading from the opening of his new memoir, The Discomfort Zone. Jonathan, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've really captured in that opening piece how emotionally complex it is to deal with your parents' house after their deaths. I mean, this piece focuses on putting that house up for sale and all the emotional and financial issues that it raises. Why did you decide to write about that?
I wrote this first chapter last, and much of the book is about me as a much younger person in these very ridiculous situations. I'm kind of the butt of most of the book's jokes. And when I went to try to find something to say about the modern me, essentially the grown-up me, I was looking for a moment where I had messed something up. And the story of trying to sell my mom's house, choosing the right realtor to do that job, made me look bad. And it seemed like if I was going to find some opening that harmonized with the ways I look bad throughout the book, that would be a good place to start.
Why write a memoir in which the unifying theme is ways in which I look bad?
I think the situation I started with was one of at least being embarrassed by who I had been. It's an interesting and strange fact that among my friends, I feel like one of the few people who actually was more or less happy, especially in high school. And the interesting and strange thing is that that is actually almost an embarrassment. You wish you could point to this very cool, fashionable disaffection, trauma even that you'd been to. And in fact, all I had to say about myself was, yeah, you know, I had a nice middle-class high school experience. I, in fact, had a good time. I had a lot of friends. We did a lot of really fun things. In the literary environment, in the world I inhabit, that becomes this thing I feel I have to conceal. So it wasn't like I disliked the person I had been, but I certainly wanted to keep that person under wraps.
Well, you know, in the opening scene that you just read, you walk into your parents' house after your mother has died. Your father had already died before that. And the first thing you do, basically, is you take all the photos and remove them. I mean, no, you're preparing the house to sell it. But you seem to want to hide the photos and just kind of get rid of that evidence of who you were. So what's the difference between the potential discomfort or embarrassment of old pictures, old photographs, and then writing about yourself and who you were at a younger time?
In that passage, I describe what I was doing as essentially an attack on my mother's religion. And this book is in many ways about religion. It's a preoccupation in pretty much every chapter, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. And the situation I find myself in as someone in his 40s, looking back at that time, is feeling, what happened to that religion of my parents? And they weren't believers. They didn't think they were going to be rewarded in heaven. But there was a whole set of things they felt with a kind of religious conviction. And that set of convictions was related to an entire set of values that defined sort of pre-1968 middle America. And the person who wants to just rip all that out is sort of the post-1968 consciousness. At the same time, there's a great sadness to doing that. And I feel caught between a tremendous sense of loss and a sense that there was no other way I could have behaved. I had to discard this, and once it was discarded, I felt terrible. And tearing the pictures off the wall was sort of the same thing. I felt like, you know, God, I'm coming in and I'm just, it's this direct attack on that which my mother wanted to surround herself with.
So in rejecting some of your mother's taste, but coming into possession of all of her possessions, you had to decide what to keep, what to give away, what to sell, and what to throw out. And that's a position that everybody is in when one of their loved ones dies. And given all the complicated emotions you were feeling about your mother and her taste and her preoccupation with the home and the home as her shrine, can you talk a little bit about what it was like when you had to decide what to keep, what to give away, what to sell, and what to throw out?
I took literally not one stick of furniture from the house. I think each of my brothers took one small thing. Almost everything I took was just boxes of my own stuff. It was really maybe one carton of mementos that had some sort of symbolic presence to me, or that I had always loved. I mean, there were these, my parents went to Mexico for their 25th anniversary and came back with these carved onyx pieces of fruit. And, you know, when I was 8 or 9 or 10, I was fascinated by the onyx banana and the onyx peach. And so in the same weird way that the week we came back to do all this, I was sleeping in my parents' bed. I mean, which is just bizarre. There I was in their bedroom, spread out on their their marital bed. The notion that I could actually possess that onyx banana, it was an odd thing. But through all of this was running not an emotion so much as a dismay over how little I felt. a dismay over the gulf between what I had been and what I am now, and the sense of a place being saturated in meaning that I had had when I was young, and the sense of it being just, you know, another ordinary house with a too small kitchen and a really bad bathroom upstairs that was not getting as much money as it ought to. Does that make sense, that the primary emotion is a dismay over a lack of emotion?
Was it a lack of emotion you expected to experience? Were you surprised at that lack of emotion, or was it consistent with how you were feeling before? I mean, had you thought ahead and think, like, your mother had been sick. She had a terminal illness. You knew she was going to die. Had you wondered what you would feel when she died, or did you expect to feel the way you felt?
Much later in the book, I talk about her death a little bit, and one of the ways in which I was ridiculous in the week following her death was to feel like, okay, I've had my cry. On day two, day three, and day four. And now it's all better. I'm getting better. I'm pretty much over it now. It's been 5 days since she died. I'm over it. And much of the project of the latter half of this book is to elucidate the subterranean ways in which those emotions, that grief specifically, disperse and then reappear in these odd places in your psychic landscape where you would least have expected it, so that I found myself obsessively birdwatching, really beginning within 48 hours of her death and then increasingly a couple of years down the line. And I can't understand things I'm doing 5, 6, 7 years after her death without reference to the death, even though, you know, at the time I thought, this isn't so bad. I've had my cry. I'm over it.
Just, you know, getting back to those, like, to the onyx banana that you decided that you would keep, where did you put it?
Where did I put it? The onyx banana often is on the dining room table. I pretend it's a cell phone and take calls on it. When it's not there, it's in a this crappy thrift store break front that I hauled home from a neighborhood thrift store, along with like a Wedgwood candy dish, a pewter candle snuffer, a little porcelain sparrow with its mouth open as if singing, tiny little thing that I'd always liked. You know, and a handful of objects like that, a nutcracker, just a metal nutcracker. I have a few more things in the closet, but almost nothing except one painting of hers on display, just a tiny little oil painting of a ship.
My guest is Jonathan Franzen. His new memoir is called The Discomfort Zone. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Franzen, and his new book is a memoir called The Discomfort Zone. In your book, you quote this letter after, you know, you go to, is it Swarthmore College?
I did go to Swarthmore College.
Yeah, so you're in Swarthmore College and, you know, studying literature, and your plan is to be a writer. And your parents are disappointed because, you know, writing isn't, it's not a reliable profession. Who knows if you can make a living at it? So it's your mother, I think, who writes you this letter expressing hers and your father's disappointment that you've chosen this life that might be so untenable. And you write her back a pretty angry letter saying that this is what you've chosen and blah, blah, blah. And she writes you back this really apologetic letter. you know, apologizing for any upset that she may have caused you and so on. And I thought there was something so sweet about that. You know, I think a lot of parents would never have written that kind of apologetic letter. This would have just led to a long fight, or you just wouldn't have spoken about it again. What was your reaction when you got that letter from her?
Oh, at the time, I'm sure I couldn't read it. I just probably read the first line and said, oh, she's being emotional, and stuck it in a drawer. I literally suspect the first time I read that letter was about 9 months ago. I'd gone into deep storage and dragged out the complete correspondence and came across that. And I found it sort of heartbreaking that she had so completely capitulated, and it was an indication of just how frightened and upset she must have been that winter, that in response to my testy, really asinine, kind of senior in college letter back, she had written this sort of scream of pain and regret.
As if maybe she was afraid of losing you over this?
Yes, I think so. And I think...
I guess I find it interesting that after probably reading only the first sentence of this letter, you saved it. You saved it in a place where it was preserved. And then you had it to later go back and older person.
I have an archival instinct.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know exactly where that came from, but somehow I find myself in possession of every letter my mother ever wrote to me, and probably everyone my brothers ever wrote, every postcard. I just kind of save it.
Earlier you were telling us that mostly in this book you've focused on incidents from your younger years that in retrospect are really kind of embarrassing and make you look foolish, but those are the things that you wanted to write about. Now, later in the book, you also write about your marriage, which ended, I guess, in the early 90s. In talking about something as adult as your marriage, and that is so bound up with another person, what approach did you want to take in discussing that?
Well, in the case of the marriage, I wanted to try to say as little specific as I could, just to protect my ex-wife, but I felt I had had a weird marriage, and I guess probably everyone feels secretly that their marriage is weird, because once you close the bedroom door, there's just this the mystery and the horror. I, in the same way that I'd gone through life with the secret of having actually been happy in high school, I felt oppressed by what seemed to me the singularity of that particular marriage, the intensity and particularly the isolation that we maintained for many years. It seemed like something that was just completely unwritable. And it happened that there were a couple of other things preoccupying me when I came to write that that chapter. I was also trying to conceal the fact that I'd become a bird watcher. It's such a nerdy thing to do. The word bird nerd just trip right off the tongue. And also, I was becoming upset anew about our environmental situation, particularly global warming. And I know from experience, from having failed in the past, that's a very hard thing to write about. It's hard to find any place to stand where you don't either sound jaded and flippant about the problem, or else horribly earnest in a way that just destroys any page of writing. That's a terrible place for a writer to be and actually be heard in this culture. So I was facing these three unwritable...
Your marriage, bird watching, and the end of the world because of global warming. Okay,
right.
Those are the three things. Okay.
All of which seem to me unwritable. And at some point I realized, I could just maybe like prop the three of them up against each other, like, three muskets by the campfire or something, and none of them would stand on their own, but I might be able to like get away with it and get at some of this embarrassing but urgent material by putting them all together.
In writing about your former marriage, you write about the isolation of the marriage, how you intentionally just kept to each other. You, during this period, it sounds like you virtually had no other close friends, that you, it sounds like you hardly left the house at times. Now, is that kind of seclusion or isolation natural to you?
Partly. I mean, I spend my life in a discomfort zone because I have strong conflicting inclinations, and part of me is very social and loves a party and loves to be around people, and another part of me is looking at his watch after half an hour, just counting the minutes till I can be back alone or alone with one other person, just in a quiet place. It's hard to be a writer if you don't have some inclination to be by yourself, because that is the thing that's hard about writing, is spending all day alone in a room.
Jonathan Franzen's new memoir is called The Discomfort Zone. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. From Windham Hill, presenting George Winston's new solo piano album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a hurricane relief benefit available at Borders. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jonathan Franzen talks about his life after his novel The Corrections made him famous, and jazz trumpeter, arranger, and bandleader Gerald Wilson looks back on his long life in music. Gary Giddens has described him as the only major figure of the swing era still working. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Franzen. He won a National Book Award for his best-selling novel, The Corrections. His new book is a memoir called The Discomfort Zone. As the title suggests, it focuses on some of the many things that have made him uncomfortable through his life. He's now at work on a new novel. I asked him if it's daunting to return to fiction after the critical and popular success of The Corrections.
It's been hard, no question. For probably pretty obvious reasons, when you feel as if no one has listened to you before and you're desperately working to write a book that people will listen to, there's this real urgency to communicate and an urgency to show this is what I can do, this is who I am, you've underestimated me. Once you've actually hit the jackpot and gotten that recognition, that urgency falls away, and what you have instead is this acute self-consciousness. Oh my God, everybody's looking. And a lot of the freedom that I felt working in what felt like total obscurity in the 90s has been replaced by a sense of, wow, there were a lot of good things that happened. There's also some hostility out there. Either way, whether it's expectation of sort of a wish for failure on some people's part and a wish for more of the same on other people's part, it's hard to clear your head of that stuff. But I wouldn't want to overstate the self-conscious aspect, because what it really is about is having lost track of who I am, lost a sense of myself, and I think most good fiction writing comes out of, you need a sense of self to do it. It may be a very blurry sense of self. And looking back at the way the writing that's been alive for me in the last few years has mostly been nonfiction about myself, it's possible to think I have been trying to sit down quietly and say, well, who am I? Who is this person who would be trying to write the next novel?
So you think that the success of The Corrections changed your life in such a way that you kind of lost track of who you were?
It literally changed me to suddenly be a person who people stop on the sidewalk and say nice things to. It's just completely weird to walk down a street feeling anonymous and have somebody turn and smile and say, God, I love what you're doing. You know, it's sort of like the Truman Show or something. You know, what? Thank you. You just made my day, whoever you are. You know, and that's, but you can no longer, maybe it's not that I have a different self, but that I'm aware of having an objective self in a way that was usefully absent for the first half of my life. It was possible to go along and pretend that I really was in the Truman Show, and suddenly, you know, there you are objectively, and there are bad pictures of you, and there are people doing all these speculations about you, who really know nothing about you, but those things have a life of their own, and they must be based on something. There must actually be an object in the room. It's not just this kind of, you know, many-feelered subjectivity, and that's all strange.
You know, earlier you were talking about how one of the themes through your new memoir is religion and faith, though it's not literally about religion. And you were saying, like, for your mother, her religion,
actually,
in a way, was her home. Yeah, go ahead.
Good chunk of the book. I mean, there's quite a long chapter that's literally about religion. So
the Fellowship?
Yeah.
It's about a church group that was a very important part of your life when you were in your early teens. But what's your substitute? Like, what is your faith now? I mean, is it religion? Is there something else that has the place of religion and faith in your life?
I think I've come to feel that if you're not constitutionally set up to believe in counterfactual things or in highly unlikely supernatural things, that a replacement for that can be a passion. It doesn't make any sense to talk about a faith in literature or even a mystical experience of nature for me, because it's not really faith. It's not the literature is demonstrably good. It entertains me. It's been important to me. It gives meaning to my life, both in my effort to make it and as a reader. Likewise, you know, being out in nature, which has suddenly come alive to me because I've gotten interested in birds. That's I don't I don't think that there's some, you know, deep nature spirit that I'm connecting with there. All I know is this gives me real joy, you know, to see the California towhee scratching in the dirt. There's something that makes me feel like I'm really alive, that I'm not just planning how I will someday be alive, or I'm not just creating theories of why I'm alive. I really am alive at that moment.
Well, Jonathan Franzen, I regret we're out of time. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you very much, too.
Jonathan Franzen's new memoir is called The Discomfort Zone. Coming up, Gerald Wilson, a jazz composer, arranger, and bandleader who just celebrated his 88th birthday and is still winning awards. This is Fresh Air. It was 67 years ago that my guest Gerald Wilson joined the popular swing band led by Jimmy Lunsford. Yesterday, he celebrated his 88th birthday. Wilson is not only still working, he's still winning awards. This year, he won the Jazz Journalists Association Award for Best Large Ensemble. This month, UCLA is honoring him as Teacher of the Year. Wilson is a trumpeter, but he's best known for his work as an arranger, composer, and bandleader. Among the luminaries he's arranged for are Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Ray Charles. Wilson has been leading his own band since the mid-40s. His latest CD, In My Time, was described by music critic Francis Davis as his finest hour. Here's a track from it called Dorian, composed and arranged by Wilson. It's Dorian from Gerald Wilson's new CD, In My Time. Gerald Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you've been playing in big bands, your own and others, for many decades, starting in the 1940s when you joined the Jimmy Lunsford Band. Give us a sense of what it's like to play or to conduct a big band, what it was like to do that, say, in the 1940s when the big bands were still really popular, and there were ballrooms that dancers would go to, and you'd be performing, and there'd be a lot of dancers on the floor, which I think is kind of rare nowadays. So,
yeah.
Give us a sense of what it was like for you as a musician to be in a band in that kind of setting.
I joined the Jimmy Lunsford Band in June of 1939, and of course I made my trip here to New York City. And they were one of the top bands in the world at that time. And playing with them was one of the dreams of my life. I had never dreamed that I'd be able to play with them, but this was one of my dreams. And it was great. Loved playing in the band. And it was wonderful to see the people out there dancing. It was just fun. It was just a life of fun doing the things that I love to do.
So when you joined the band, did you have to get a uniform? What did you wear?
Well, that's very good you asked me that question, because I arrived here in New York. The first thing I had to do, one of the other trumpet players in the band met me, and then he took me to the tailor here in New York to measure me for my uniforms. Not one uniform, but for seven.
Were they all the same?
No, there was one was the way they ran them. It was the first uniform in the morning when we would play morning shows, before that is, before noon, we would wear the English walking suits. Yes, these are black jackets that have braid around them, and then you wear them with gamble stripe trousers. And we had all seven different. Then the next show, which would be, we'd wear, might have a sporty uniform on. After that, it would be another kind of a suit. Up until the last show, which we would do seven shows, like at the Paramount Theater here in New York, we'd do seven shows on the weekend. And at the very end, we would have on our formal dress.
So how did you clean all these suits when you were on the road?
Well, we have the valets, we call them valets at that time, that handled all of that. We had trunks to carry all of that in, all of our uniforms, all of our shoes. Everything was alike. The band, when they would get on the stand, every guy was dressed alike. And they would take them and get them to the cleaners, and they would be ready for us whenever we were to play.
And did you like that aspect of performance?
Oh, I loved every moment of it. This is a dream coming true for me. And I loved every moment of it that I spent with the Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra, making records, playing theaters, making movies. You know, we were in Blues in the Night, one of the biggest Warner Brothers movies of all time. We were featured in that, on things like that. And we played the Paramount here in New York. We were just, we played this Lowe's State. We played the Apollo five or six times a year. We played nothing but the biggest jobs, and always booked, too, by the way.
One of the first arrangements of yours and compositions that became famous was something that you wrote, co-wrote, I guess, for the Jimmy Lunceford Band, and it's called Yard Dog Mazurka.
Yes.
Let's start with the title. How did you come up with that title?
Okay, well, I didn't name that tune. The name was given to me by a young man who was another writer with the Jimmy Lunceford Band. His name was Roger Segura. And the way the number happened, it wasn't going to be an original composition. I was starting to write an arrangement, an orchestration on Stomping at the Savoy. So I had written the introduction out, and I happened to be over at Roger's home that evening here in New York. And I said to Roger, I says, "Hey, Roger, listen to my introduction here that I'm writing for Stomping at the Savoy." And I played it on the piano for him. And he said, "Hey, that's very good, Gerald." He says, "Why don't you just go on and make yourself a bridge to it, and then you'll have an original composition." So I thought about that, and I said to my, "That was a good idea." And I said, "Roger, you know, I never would have thought of that." And I says, you gave me the idea. I'm going to give you half of the number." And I gave him half of the number. That's why you see his name there as co-composer.
When you say half the number, you mean half the royalties.
That's what I mean.
Half the songwriting credit and half the royalties.
Yeah, the credit and that, you know. Which was a good idea. I would have done it anyway because I never would have thought of it. And I would have written an arrangement on Stopping at the Savoy.
Well, why don't we hear Yard Dog Mazurka, composed and arranged by my guest Gerald Wilson, recorded by the Jimmy Lunceford Band in 1941. And the first solo you'll hear, the trumpet solo, is by Gerald Wilson. Here it is. Thank you. That's Yard Dog Mazurka, the Jimmy Lunsford Band, and the composition was composed and arranged by my guest Gerald Wilson, who also took that trumpet solo. You grew up in Shelby, Mississippi.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what your town was like when you were a boy.
Okay, I was born in 1918, as you know, and my mother was a school teacher. She was also a music teacher. She played piano. She played piano in the school. She played piano in the church. And she taught me how to read music when I was a little boy. 5 years old, I'd already started reading music. And I was in music all my life. My sister was a classical pianist. I knew all about Rachmaninoff and Beethoven and Bach and D'Andre and Ravel and Debussy and all of those when I was a little kid, listening to my sister play this music. My brother was also a pianist. He could play jazz and the piano. He's a graduate from Tuskegee Institute. And it was music in my house all day long. That's all I ever heard was music all day, and I loved it, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a jazz musician.
What was your school like in Shelby, Mississippi?
My school, of course, we know that it was segregated. It only went to the eighth grade. After the eighth grade, you'd have to go away. In the case of my sister and brother, they went to other schools. But in my case, I was lucky enough to go to Memphis, Tennessee. My home is only 80 miles south of Memphis, Tennessee. I went to Memphis, Tennessee, where I studied was in high school for 3 years. And by the way, it's the same school that Jimmy Lunsford had been a teacher and the football coach.
Is that where you first heard of him?
No, I actually heard him before that because I'd hear them on the radio.
Okay,
I used to
listen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I used to listen to all the bands on the radio. I sold the radio guide in my hometown. I sold the black newspapers, the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, and the Baltimore African-American newspaper so I could keep up with what all the bands were doing, like Duke Ellington and Chick Webb and all the great black bands of that time. And I listened to all the white bands at that time.
And then you went to Detroit after that.
Yes, I went to the World's Fair in Chicago in 1934, and I was certainly taken away with Chicago. It was this big city, more liberty for blacks, a better outlook at life. And I begged my mother to send me to Chicago after I got home from the fair. And she says, well, look, I can't send you to Chicago, but I can send you to Detroit, Michigan. So all I wanted to do was get to the north. So that was great with me. There was a family that had lived two doors from us in Mississippi, and they agreed to let me come and live with them while I was attending school in Detroit, Michigan.
So the school you attended there was high school, college?
It was high school.
High school.
The name of that school is Cass Tech. It's still there, by the way, and it's one of the greatest schools in the world. In fact, they would be rated as Juilliard number one and Cass Tech number two. And as I say, we had music all day. You had to study band, you had to study harmony, you had to study orchestration, you had to study percussion, you had to play in the different bands, jazz bands, whatever, at the school. It was just music all day.
My guest is trumpeter, composer, arranger, and bandleader Gerald Wilson. His latest CD is called In My Time. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is trumpeter, composer, arranger, and bandleader Gerald Wilson. His latest CD is called In My Time. We talked a little bit about bands that you've played with.
Yes.
Now, you've also done arranging for singers. Some of those singers include Ray Charles, Bobby Darin, Nancy Wilson. Who else?
Well, we'll go Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, as you say, Carmen McRae, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington.
How is arranging for a singer different than arranging just an instrumental for a band?
Well, the thing about the way I approach it myself, I stay out of the way of the singer. I try to, when I have to bring in the band, I bring it in. I have to, and of course, I try to use great harmony for them and to make the voice sound better. I use my eight parts if I feel like it. And I try to many composers write numbers and they don't know the inside of deep harmony, so you have to go in and figure that out so and change it to what it should be. I do that, and as I said, working with these great artists, I just enjoy doing that. And of course, as you said, Ray Charles, modern sounds in country and western music, which I did all of the music for that. And again, I think that's a time when if they would give us a little attention and say, when he finished singing You Are My Sunshine and Bye Bye Love and all of those country tunes, yeah, I'd sure be happy if they'd said my name, that I'm the one who orchestrated it. And I'd appreciate that.
Well, why don't we hear a track from Ray Charles, Modern Sounds in Country and Western, and the music on this album was arranged by my guest, Gerald Wilson.
Yep!
That's Ray Charles from an album that was arranged by my guest, Gerald Wilson. For those of us who haven't had the pleasure of actually seeing you conduct,
yes.
What's your style of conducting?
Different from any style you've ever seen before. I move. I choreograph the music as I conduct. You see, I pointed out everything you to listen to. People can't keep their eyes off of me.
So you're making it sound like you point things out not for the benefit of the musicians, like it's your turn, read section, but for the benefit of the listener?
No, for the benefit of the listener, he sees what everything is happening, because every time I move, something happens there where I move. My two hands here showing you where to look. If I want them to concentrate on my soloist, I concentrate on him. And they pinpoint where they're to look now and listen as they look. I think that's what I am. That's the way I can explain it now. I choreograph my music.
Gerald Wilson, you're 87 now, and that's an age at which most people, if they're lucky enough to have lived that long, have retired. You have not. You're still composing, arranging, conducting. You have a new CD. So are there aspects of your work that you feel age has interfered with?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I'm working all the time, fooling around, playing the piano so that I can get new things that have been going. And so it hasn't affected me at all. I feel good, and I'm hanging in there.
Well, Gerald Wilson, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure and my honor, Terry.
Gerald Wilson, we recorded the interview when he was still 87. Yesterday, he celebrated his 88th birthday. Next month, he'll perform with his band for a week in Manhattan at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola. Wilson's latest CD is called In My Time. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberto Schirach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another track from Gerald Wilson's In My Time. The trumpeter is John Faddis.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the book Bush's Brain, journalist Wayne Slater examined Karl Rove's role in shaping the career of George W. Bush. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Slater about his new book, The Architect, which analyzes Rove's strategy for the Republican Party. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.